You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Do human beings have free will, or are our lives determined by the same physical laws that control the world around us? It's a question that philosophers and theologians have wrestled with for millennia, and one that Michael S. Gazzaniga, one of the world's top neuroscientists, addresses in his latest book, Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain. Dr. Gazzaniga is the director of the SAGE Center for the Study of the Mind and is a professor of psychology at the University of California. His book is published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him back to our show. It's a pleasure to see you again.
Thank you.
Haven't you been called the father of neuroscience? Is that possible? You don't seem all that old. Or is neuroscience more recent development than I think it is?
The generous description is the father of cognitive neuroscience, not neuroscience. And that was a specialization within the field that occurred around 1980s, and I was part of that.
In reading this book, I got the feeling that you wrote it in response to what you think are simplifications and misunderstandings of some of the work that's been done in your field.
I wrote it as a statement to show people what we now know about the brain, and more of a guide to what we know about the brain. So it's an attempt to inform people that as we learn more about the brain, we're going to have a different view of ourselves. And the question is, does that different view challenge essential human qualities that we all insist on? And the point of the book is that while we are illuminating why we do things the way we do them, how it works in a mechanistic way, it doesn't really impact the essential question, which is, are we responsible for our actions?
You say there's a belief among some members of the intellectual community that we live in a completely determined universe, I guess a mechanistic one, that physical laws govern our behavior and even our conscious self. Haven't some of the discoveries that you and other scientists have made about the human brain and how it works contributed to this idea?
Oh, yeah, sure. The notion that we live in a we're living at a time where we think that the brain is determined by certain mechanisms, a mechanistic view of the brain, is upon us. And I come back to the point. The question is, as we learn more about that and as we know more about that, does that mean we're not responsible for our actions? And what I argue is that you don't look into the brain for the answer to that question. You look at how social groups interact.
But there is that that whole matter of how much of what our brain tells us is done automatically. And there is all of this stuff now about whether we should trust our gut instincts, mm-hmm. and whether that is whether they lead us in the wrong direction, the right direction. Mm-hmm. But they seem to be based on hard wiring.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a tremendous amount of hard wiring. There's a tremendous amount of common moral responses we have to various challenges. That's all there. You know, if you really look at it, 99.9% of the brain's activities goes on outside of our conscious awareness. I mean, just you forming a question there involves all kinds of brain systems that you don't have access to. It just gets done for you.
And I'm breathing at the same time.
And you're breathing at the same time. And we have this wonderfully complex layered system that allows for all those things. So when you really think about it, it's only 0.001% of your brain activity that is conscious. And that's what we're talking about. And people hold on to that 0.001%, whatever it is, and say, now that, the things I make and decide up there, those were done freely, whatever that means. And the viewpoint, I think it's just time for us to change how we think about that.
Isn't part of the problem that all of that debate has grown out of religious thinking and philosophical thinking and not really out of the science of looking how the brain works?
That's exactly right. It was deepened and expanded on by brilliant, highly intelligent philosophers at a time when the knowledge of the brain and its detail as we have today wasn't around. So I like to say that if a Martian landed on Earth now and said, okay, you know, what are these things? And he looks at the human, the last thing he would do is assign to a human this thing called free will. No, they work this way over here. We don't need this concept. But that's a hard thing for us to accept because as you and I may talk freely about determinism and free will, we all actually kind of believe we're free and we're in charge of our actions. There's something phenomenologically so real about that.
Well, we know that we've made decisions in our lives right. that turned out to be good for us, and we know that we've made decisions that we have regretted from that moment on.
We know all those things, and yet it's still part of a system that makes those decisions built on experience, built on payoffs from the past, built on innate predispositions. It all comes together into this decision-making device.
Now, your early work had to do with left brain, right brain, and how they determine different things. In the past, I guess everybody thought the brain was integrated and there were no separations. When was that?
The 50 years ago, I can't believe it, was the first study.
You were still in school?
I was a graduate student at Caltech, best 5 years of my life. But that's when we discovered and worked out the whole story of left brain, right brain, and the fantastic consequence and interest in the patients who had their brains.
And does that play a role in what we're discussing now?
It does, in the sense that it helps us realize how vastly parallel and distributed, modularized our brain is. There's stuff all over the brain where specific functions are carried out. And that's a big part of our understanding about how the brain is organized today.
My guest is Michael S. Gazzaniga, the director of the SAGE Center for the Study of the Mind at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His latest book, Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain, published by ECHO. Your research was done at, as I said, the California Institute of Technology on people with so-called split brains. They'd undergone surgery to sever the fibers that connected the two hemispheres of their brains to reduce epileptic seizures. What made them good subjects for this kind of research?
Well, when one has their two hemispheres surgically divided with no other existing pathology, you have sort of a clean shot at figuring out how each hemisphere works and what it contributes to the overall cognitive states that we all enjoy. And that's what we did. So we studied left brain processes separately from the right and right brain processes separately from the left.
Well, how do you do that? You showed words to people and matched them to the left brain, left hemisphere and the right hemisphere.
Right.
But when I hear a word, I'm not thinking, oh, this is going to the left or the right.
Right, right. We sure don't. But the way you do it builds on the basic anatomy of our visual system. So if anybody listening to the show fixates a point on the wall, everything to the left of that point goes to your right brain. Everything to the right goes to your left brain. So you have an automatic way of presenting stuff to one brain or the other. And that's what we did. We basically flashed things to one visual field or the other.
And you learned that the left side is responsible for language. The right side processes images.
Right. And it's superior at some various kinds of perceptual matching tasks and a bunch of stuff.
What happens when people are left-handed? Does that confuse things?
It can. Left-handed people still usually have a left-dominant hemisphere, but a higher percentage of them are bilaterally organized.
When you started doing this research, did the scientific community immediately embrace your work?
I think so. Because it was experimentally based. I mean, we reported the patients, reported the surgery, and reported the experimental results. So you can always look at whether they did the experiments correctly. And then in neuroscience, and it's in so much cognitive neuroscience, there's a wide range of interpretations of the data, which people will discuss endlessly. But the data is the data.
But then you say it took another 25 years to develop an experiment that would reveal how the brain synthesized and made sense of the sometimes disparate information that it received from the two brain hemispheres. Mm-hmm. And that research involved showing another split brain patient photographs of a chicken claw and snow.
Yes, it's amazing.
How did you come up with the ideas of a chicken claw and snow?
I forget how we came up with that. It was a simple test where one hemisphere we showed a chicken claw and the other hemisphere we showed a snow scene. Now, you and I would just say, well, I saw a chicken claw and a snow scene because our brains are tied together. what these patients would say is they only said, I saw the chicken claw. And so that could be the end of it. But it took us 25 years to figure out to lay out in front of them a bunch of choices. And in that situation, the hands would point to the correct answer. So the left brain pointed to the chicken that matched the chicken claw, and the right pointed to a shovel that matched the snow scene. Then with them actually pointing their hands, then you ask the question, why did you do that? And the patients quickly responded, oh, well, the chicken claw goes with the chicken because it's the left hemisphere talking. And then looking down at his left hand says, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed. So this interpreter, as we called it, this interpreter.
He said chicken shed in shed. Case the FCC is listening. Okay.
Shed. This interpreter immediately integrates this behavior coming out and puts it into a narrative and a storyline that becomes part of one's.
And you call this the interpreter.
Yes.
So when we do this all the time.
That's right.
People who are not split brain, we still do this. We explain things to ourselves, put things together. This is why we sometimes see subtext when there isn't.
Right. The exact point is that the split-brain patient is simply a way of gaining insight into our own selves, and it's a model for how you and I function.
You explain that the interpreter constantly creates explanations for events by looking for meaningful patterns and then develops a narrative to explain them. Does the interpreter just work with the information it has available, or does it make up things to create a plausible story?
Well, it's certainly...
cleaning out the chicken shed is making up things, isn't it?
It's making up things, but it's making up things that sound completely reasonable given the context that the person is sitting in. It's not... If your hand went out and magically did something and I asked you, why'd you do that, you would pretty quickly have a reason why, even though the reasons for actually doing it were quite different.
During your research, didn't you watch some people create some fairly implausible stories to explain things that you'd shown to the two hemispheres of their brains separately? Did they believe those stories?
Oh, yeah. We believe our stories.
Right? Well, something that's striking about the interpreter, if I understand it correctly, is that it creates its explanation for whatever's going on before the conscious brain is even aware that any action has taken place. Mm-hmm. So does the interpreter essentially create our consciousness?
It certainly creates a lot of our beliefs that become part of our consciousness. I think consciousness is it would be too strong to say that this interpreter mechanism is the thing of consciousness. I think consciousness is a whole different ball game, and it has different mechanisms. But we are conscious about stuff. But the interpreter is this thing that gets the narrative going as to why we do the things we do.
So it makes the consciousness feel like a united whole?
Yeah. It pulls together this highly parallel brain with all these separate modules and all alike and the like, and it creates this common story that becomes our personal story.
So when we're in a situation where a lot of different stimuli are all coming at us at the same time, the interpreter is putting that into some kind of a context and saying, well, this is because whatever. The fire alarm has gone off.
Yeah, there's things working at various levels. I mean, at the level of just simple perception, there's other specialized systems that put them together into a figural whole so that we appreciate the percept. But when it comes to actual behavior and cognitive acts, getting those looped together into a rationale is what the interpreter does.
My guest is Michael S. Gazzaniga, Gazzaniga. His latest book, Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain, published by Echo. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Michael S. Gazzaniga, who is the director of the SAGE Center for the Study of the Mind at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His latest book is Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain. It's published by Echo. Is it this aspect of your brain research that has some people has led some people to question the idea of personal responsibility. If the brain seems to be acting before our conscious mind is even aware of it, it seems as though we don't have a choice about what we're doing. We're just reacting to it.
Well, I make an argument that that is not the right way to look at it. That, in fact, if you want to look for the mechanisms of responsibility, you don't look at the brain. You look at how people interact. So if you take a step back and you ask yourself the question, if you were the only person on Earth, what would there be a concept of personal responsibility? No, because your personal responsibility means you're responsible to somebody else. And so when we come together into a social group, there are laws that are set down, there are rules that are followed. And no matter what we know mechanistically about the brain and come to know, which is going to be even more, it doesn't impact that reality, that social level of exchange. And so the way I like to summarize that is, while our brains may be automatic, people are free, because we hold that out as where to look for the issue of social of personal responsibility.
But aren't we also making decisions based on everything we know and on our past experiences?
Of course, of course. We're gathering information. We're learning from the past experience about the payoff of thinking a certain thing, of behaving in a certain way. That's all part of our decision-making. And one can say our freedom is in the quest for always learning and trying to acquire new information. As someone put it to me the other day, what we humans are really trying to do is become less stupid. And by becoming less stupid, we make better decisions and everything in life is better.
You mentioned earlier the whole bad matter of the brain working automatically, like causing our hearts to beat or our lungs to breathe without us being aware of it. But you tell the story in your book about hiking in the desert in Southern California when you were a child and jumping because you thought that you'd heard a snake rustle in the grass. Is that the same kind of automatic response?
Well, there are levels and levels of these automatic responses. If I reach over and pick up this glass of water on the table, there are thousands of unconscious processes that went into that calculation to make that movement possible.
And muscles throughout your arm and your hands.
And all of which contain information, so that the message that actually gets to them is only partial, because there's a lot of information out there evolution has figured out they can use. So, yes, there's these layers and layers of operations going on, and we all accept that. We all accept that, and we all know that.
But in the case of the snake, I had a friend who, if a snake came on the screen while she was watching a film, she would shriek. Yeah. And cover her eyes. Yeah. And she felt that it was hardwired into her from the time that humans were in the savannah.
Yeah. There are various things that are hardwired, and people's fear of snake is pretty high on the list. But
we usually, most people will distinguish between a dangerous snake and a non-dangerous snake.
Yeah.
Then there are people who just will freak out. You don't? Any snake is a bad snake.
Oh, bad. The way they slither along, you know.
But I guess what I was leading to is wondering whether the development of the interpreter is the result of an evolutionary process.
Well, I mean, everything is. And the question of wanting to figure out maybe why did that I put this food outside my cave last night and I don't see it this morning, and I see my neighbor there is grinning. Maybe I got to figure out what's going on here. So I think the interpreter's first thing was trying to figure out why A causes between A and B. And then that just grew into this thing to build the story of the narrative. Well, so to give it maybe a concrete example of that, if you in a lot of these moral judgment tests, you can give moral questions to people all over the world, a particular kind of question. And 90% of the people of the world answer it in a particular way. That's just facts. That's been well worked out by lots of people. Now you ask them, why did you respond that way? And you get 10 gazillion different kinds of answers, because each one of them has an interpreter who's had different experience in their life, who therefore weaves a different story why they do the things they do. But yet there was obviously some fundamental wiring common to all of them that allowed for the initial response.
So if we would all say you shouldn't steal, right. except a few sociopaths.
Right.
We all agree on that, but we don't necessarily agree on why we shouldn't steal.
Right. Or who told us or who taught us why not to steal when in fact it just seems to be a property of humans.
Is there a problem here in that we have to make a distinction between the brain and the mind?
Well, distinctions to be made. While everybody in neuroscience thinks that the brain enables the mind, it's also a layered system, so that the brain generates the mind, but the mind in turn constrains the brain. And it's that interaction of those layers which is really the central deep question of neuroscience. How does that work?
Well, you write that one way to understand how the brain and the mind are related is to think of them in terms of computers. The brain is the hardware and the mind is the software.
Right.
So the brain enables the mind as a computer's hardware enables the software?
Yeah, the notion there is that it's their interaction. The metaphor works sort of. There's an interaction between the hardware and the software to produce the functionality, the PowerPoint show you may be seeing. But each has its own status on its own. The software is one layer, the hardware is another layer, and it's the interaction that causes the functionality. So you can't have it without them interacting.
Does the mind, which has emerged from the brain, also in turn act to constrain the brain and monitor its behavior the way a government created by a society then provides constraints on the society that conceived it?
That's the idea. Stuff at one level can construct something at another level that still interacts with the level that generated it. That's the whole mind-brain interface, and you see it in all through biology and all the way up into social groups.
But you say we still haven't developed a language to describe everything that happens?
Those layered interactions, we do not have a good vocabulary for that. That is the challenge of the next century, I think.
My guest is Michael S. Gazzaniga. His latest book, Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain. It's published by Echo. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the last chapter of your book, you described how some of the new information that neuroscience has uncovered about the human brain has begun to challenge some people's ideas of criminal behavior and how that behavior should be dealt with. How has the legal system been dealing with neuroscience?
Well, I've just been part of a large study group that was trying to figure out where neuroscience should be in the judicial system and where it should not be. And I think, to just shorthand it, I think most neuroscientists and legal scholars think that it's a little too soon for wholesale importing of neuroscience into the courtroom. But it will come.
Well, what are they doing? They're bringing in MRIs to show that a person has certain damaged areas of the brain?
Right. So someone has, let's say, a frontal lobe damage. Now you bring in a picture of the frontal lobe damage. And is that prejudicial to the jury? Is overstating something? Does it have a greater significance than it does? And take that example. The reason why that is of limited interest is because there's lots of people with that same lesion who have not engaged in antisocial behavior. So what does it mean? And you can see how it's just a little too early and premature for that to be overused.
But even if it is significant, isn't that a double-edged sword? On the one hand, it says this person may not be responsible because of the lesion. On the other hand, it may also suggest that this person will be compelled to do the same sort of thing again and again and again because of that lesion.
Yeah, except that it doesn't seem to work that way. And in fact, as hard as you might try to use that data to predict future behavior, we don't do a very good job at it.
You seem to have particular concerns about brain scans being introduced into evidence, and you describe a case in Pennsylvania involving a man named Simon Perella, who had received two death sentences in 1983 following a murder conviction. Can you tell us what happened when the scans were introduced in that case?
In that particular case, the introduction of the scans afterward caused the judge to give him a different sentence.
There was a resentencing here.
It was the payoff from a few lawyers who took the case to heart on, I think, a pro bono basis, if I remember. and finally found out he did have brain damage, and it was a mitigating circumstance. So that's the question. How will this information grow into mitigation? I think in general, what I think is the proper way to look at it is that once we come to the conclusion that we're going to hold people responsible for their acts, but then we have to decide as society what we want to do with them. And that's a difficult, hard issue. Let's imagine in the future that we know enough about neuroscience such that we say, well, you know, we can fix that brain. That person did those kinds of things because of X. We're not there yet by a long shot, but let's say we could. Would we as humans say, oh, well, sure, just fix them, just like you'd fix a car. Sure, just fix it. Broken, fix it. That is a deep question that a lot of people have a lot of problems with.
Well, we've had similar problems with the insanity defense in the past.
Right.
And, we've seen people who we would describe as being seriously mentally ill who still are sentenced to long prison terms because of their crimes. Other people are sent off to mental hospitals and then... in some cases, they say, well, I've been cured, and even though I killed John Lennon, I think I should be released.
Right. Those are social decisions. Those are decisions that we as a culture are going to have to make as to whether we accept that reasoning and accept the empirical work that would suggest that that is true or not. It's a very simple kind of question.
But you also say that scans can look different depending on whether the person has had caffeine recently, smoked tobacco, is tired, has had certain illnesses. There are all sorts of factors that might affect the way the scan looks at any given moment.
That's right. And those are all reasons why to be cautious now about the introduction of scans. One of the biggest is that most studies that you will see in the newspaper are the result of averaged scans. They take 12 people in the experiment and they average it all together to get the effect that you see. Well, how do you go from that kind of finding to a specific defendant sitting in the court? So from the collected data to the individual is a big issue, too, that has to be worked out.
There's even a debate over whether DNA is always a good determinant as to whether somebody did the crime or not. Here we're talking about something that's a lot hazier than that.
Well, DNA is the gold standard. If neuroscience gets anywhere close to that, it'll be a happy day amongst the neuroscientists.
Didn't this book grow out of a presentation for the Gifford Lecture Series in Edinburgh, Scotland? Mm-hmm. That's something that deals with religion, science, and philosophy. Mm-hmm. So when you were writing your lectures, were you thinking along all those lines, or did you just limit yourself to your scientific work?
No, it's actually the lecture series is called Natural Theology, Interested in Natural Theology, and Lord Gifford, who funded these things 125 years ago, whenever it was, said everybody should be open and free to talk about their work and let chips fall where they may. And over the years, William James gave the first lectures, Niels Bohr,
Alfred North Whitehead.
I mean, it's a long range of people.
Well, the reason I asked is when you're dealing with these subjects and free will comes up, don't you have to take philosophy and theology into consideration even though you may see yourself as being a pure scientist?
Surely you read it and you are knowledgeable about it, but... the only thing you can do is get straight your story that comes from your own work. And that's what I tried to do. Because if you wander off into another man's area, you will find out there's all sorts of nuance and details that you're not capturing correctly. So you tell your story.
Well, part of the problem also is that no two humans are alike. I was made very aware of that in discussing autism, where we look for some kind of cookie-cutter diagnosis for autism, but you take three autistic people and put them in a room and you say, these are three very different people. What the only thing they have in common is a diagnosis of autism.
Yeah, it's typical of a syndrome. It's not a thing. It's a description of behavior that falls into a general category.
So when we're talking about the way the brain works and how we make our decisions, aren't we really talking about, I don't know how many billion people there are in the world, but a billions and billions of different possibilities?
For the general mechanisms and schema of how the brains work, we're talking about a mechanism that we're all trying to understand, which will be common to all of us.
But the details, what we do with it.
The details and variations are rich and plentiful, and the interpreter's there to give it each its own twist.
I welcome you back with the next book. This one is called Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain. It's published by Echo. My great thanks to Professor Michael S. Gazzaniga for visiting us once again on the show.
Thank you.